Well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I hope that you mute any sound on your side so that we can maximize the bandwidth for my side. Let me just give you a hint of the environment. I think this is kind of relevant to the topic. First of all, first thing I'm going to do here, and I'll just show you. You should be able to see this here. I'm going to put another coin into the machine because that's how this is being done. I'm using coin-operated internet wireless service in a hotel called Puerto Plata. That's just down the road from the hotel that I'm staying at here in the Canary Islands. And it is wireless, so I should be able to do this as well. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. There we go. Now you're back. I'm just going to take you for a quick little tour here. So that's me dropping my chair. So, you know, if I am an IMAX size, this should be pretty impressive. So what we have here in the background there it is. It's kind of, I'm working on a square that's less than 1 inch to frame your video. But that's the resort that I'm in here on the Canary Islands. And what's interesting is that not that I'm in the Canary Islands or not that this is a resort, but rather that this is even possible. Now I'm back in the room here. So I'm just putting the chair back in, plugging the computer back on. I just wanted you to see that because, you know, when I first started writing about the future of online learning 10 years ago, this is the sort of thing that was thought of at the time is just not possible. Couldn't do it. The Canary Islands is an island group, if you're not familiar with them, about the same latitude as the Sahara Desert, and roughly the same climate, and a few hundred kilometers off the coast of Africa. We're pretty remote here, and bandwidth can still be a little bit of an issue, but nonetheless, I'm able to do a live video conference with you in Wisconsin from here in the Canary Islands, and that's what the future of online learning has become. What I want to talk about in this particular session, I've got, it looks like 50 minutes left, which is not bad. Our setup issues weren't that bad, actually, once we hit on the technology that worked. And I do hope you're hearing the audio on this okay. I know the audio isn't perfect, always with Skype. If you are hearing it okay, if you can just nod, and I'll be able to see you nod. And it's a bit jittery, but you appear to be jittery nodding. We'll put that into the lexicon of new words. So it's sort of hard for as usual with an audio and video session like this, it's sort of hard for me to work with limited interaction from you, even though we're connected by video conferencing. You are all still approximately, well, not even an inch high on my screen, and so obviously, I'm not getting a whole lot of detail. Anyhow, the talk. Yes, I do want to do the talk. One of the things I've been working on while I've been here, and indeed over the last few weeks, 10 years ago, I wrote a paper called The Future of Online Learning. And that paper, well, it was a bit surprising, the reception it got. It got a very good reception, a very widespread reception. And 10 years later, it seems like a good time to revisit a lot of what I said in the future of online learning. Now, I'm not going to be able to cover the entire paper in this talk because that simply wouldn't be possible. But I do want to cover some of the major elements of the paper that I talked about, because one of the things about the paper is that it really has stood the test of time, and a lot of the things that I thought would be the case 10 years ago have transpired. And it's interesting to look at that, and it's interesting because what I thought the future of learning was 10 years ago remains to a large degree what I think the future of learning is today. And consequently, when I look at the future of online learning today, I can use it equally as a way to look forward into the future. So the first thing that I looked at when I looked at the future of online learning was I looked at internet technology and computer technology in particular. And there are several aspects to this. It's sort of weird because the video coming from your end isn't totally reliable. And so somebody sort of wandered into the room and sat down near the front as I was speaking. But his standing image has frozen into the background. And, of course, Skype will update that only if something changes, and nothing is changing. This is just a big wall there. So I have this frozen image of somebody standing, towering over everybody as though he's, like, 18 feet tall. Anyhow, you sort of have to use your imagination, even with live video of real events. Where I started my paper, oh, now the standing figure is gone. Somebody must have moved the camera. Where I started my paper 10 years ago was with the issue of bandwidth. And bandwidth, if you think back to 1998, bandwidth was an issue. I talked about 28K modems as being something that we should all aspire to sometime in the future. Today, as we can see, I have in my notes, because I was predicting a future event, I have a realistic chance of video conferencing from the Canary Islands. Bandwidth has reached the point where we can go from short little text bursts to broadband streaming events like this. And, if we look forward into the future, bandwidth is only going to get better. As I was getting set up for this talk, I received a Facebook message asking, how somebody could sit in on my session. And of course, there's no way to do that, but it will be, I would say, normal for a session like this to be offered, not simply to a room like this, not simply point to point, but for it to be very easily broadcast around the world, so that if I do an online talk like this from the Canary Islands or from wherever, it will be possible for you and everybody else in the world to sit in on this and watch it with real proper video, not all pixelated kind of video, which is less than ideal. Now, bandwidth is admittedly still unevenly distributed. There's still many areas of the world in which bandwidth is still an issue. But for most of the world, and even large parts of the developing world, multimedia is a reality. Online applications like Facebook and Flickr and other social networks and whatever are also realities. And that is the overcoming of what has been a significant issue. 10 years ago I talked about things like using satellites, and you may recall all the talk about using satellites for internet connectivity, and that was tried and mostly abandoned, although we do have satellite radio. But the other part of this, the idea of wireless internet, I think is something that has really come into the fore. And again, it's not simply that I'm broadcasting from the Canary Islands here. I'm using wireless internet, which means I can wander around the hotel if I want. And we're going to see more and more of that in the future with the deployment of WiMAX and other wireless internet systems, so that one tower, like a radio tower in this resort, will provide broadband internet access for everybody, no matter where they are in the resort. And that's the same is true of your own community. Computers is the next thing that I talked about, and Windows notwithstanding, computers have become more reliable today. And I talked then about the advent of 64-bit processing in 1998. We have just gone through the convulsion known as the conversion from 16-bit to 32-bit processing. And some of you may recall when Windows 32-bit Windows 95 came onto the scene and everybody had to buy new applications. 64-bit processing has arrived. It arrived first, of course, in the form of games and gaming consoles. But this computer that I'm on now is the MacBook Pro. Very quietly introduced 64-bit processing without fanfare and is producing very rapid, very reliable computing. I think the failure of Windows Vista is a good indication of where things are going in the future. I think that the era of computers and computing is... That would be the cleaning person. This is a bit of an ad hoc setup here. The idea of computers as big desktop applications with monolithic operating systems and huge bulky applications like Microsoft Word, I think that model of computing has peaked and is in the decline now. I think we're moving toward more specialized computers. In my own company, or my own organization, I should say, the National Research Council, the laptop is now the standard. They don't fund desktop computers anymore unless you show a need for them. The expectation is that your desk computer will be your road computer. We're seeing more specialized computers. We're seeing computers such as the one laptop per child dedicated to learning, or computers dedicated to gaming, such as the Nintendo Wii, computers dedicated to communicating, such as the BlackBerry. And as I talked about then, I can talk about now, embedded computing, that is to say, computers embedded in other devices, has become so commonplace that it's now something we don't even talk about it anymore. It's just taken for granted. If you buy a car, it's going to have a computer in it. If you buy a camera, it's going to have a computer in it. It will be a computer. And if you buy an oven, it will have a computer in it. Now, again, we haven't really moved to the era of the connected toaster yet, but we are definitely on the way. You know, it's funny, people talk about how quickly the future moves. From my perspective, and I don't think I'm unique in this, the future moves very slowly. 10 years ago, I talked about connected toasters and connected fridges and all of that, and it seemed like a realistic possibility. 10 years later, it still seems like a realistic possibility, but it hasn't happened yet. And in efforts to move it forward, like the way, for example, Walmart attempted to implement the use of RFID chips, that is, small wireless chips in its products, that stalled. And it stalled because Walmart suppliers just weren't ready to work to that kind of technical standard. So the future moves slowly, but we can still see that the future is moving in that direction. I made a comment a few minutes ago about operating system, and I want to linger on that because, I say Vista failed. Now, Vista, in a certain degree, did not fail. It's going to make money for Microsoft. But, you know, after all that development, all that work, and all that hype, it turns out not to have been a huge improvement in the operating system. Where we're headed with computers is not this large sort of operating system, but rather a much more tiered sort of system. I talked about the 64-bit computer just a few minutes ago. Now, the next major advance in computing, from my perspective, isn't going to be so much in processor speed and processor power, but rather in the employment of multiprocessors. And indeed, this MacBook Pro that I'm using is a dual core. And we're going to see more and more of that, where computers, even small computers, are dual core, quad core, whatever. And that creates a tiered sort of computing environment where you have one type of subsystem that basically acts as an agent that coordinates activities and requests among the different cores, among the different processors. And then another layer operating above that, which we might think of as a virtual machine that does the actual sort of task that we've envisioned with the operating system. And we were seeing a lot of these virtual machines already come into play. VMware, for example, is one. Or on this Macintosh, I use a system called Parallels that allows me to run Microsoft Windows. It allows me to run Linux. It allows me to run the Macintosh OS X operating system. And, you know, when I'm in that sort of environment, it really doesn't matter what sort of hardware is running underneath it. And what's really interesting about that sort of application is I can take that application, I can take that virtual machine and create an image of it, a disk image of it, and take that virtual machine and put it on some other hardware. And so long as that other hardware has the subsystems, so long as that other hardware has a way of interacting with the processors, I can take my computer, quote-unquote computer, from one physical instantiation to another, to another, to another. And so the concept of a computer is something even that is beginning to change now, where the hardware fades into the background, the operating system fades into the background, or what we think of as our computer is really this disk image that we carry around with us. This becomes important because now the computer is data, and because it's data, it doesn't have to exist in one place. It doesn't have to be a single disk image. It doesn't have to be a single physical instantiation. It can be something that is genuinely virtual in the sense that it exists partly as this disk image and partly as data, content, whatever, spread out across the internet. This is especially the case when I think of the applications that I use. There's no need for me to carry around with me a word processor or a photo editor or anything like that. What I really need to carry around for me is my data, so long as I can access these applications in the environment I happen to be, whether the application is resident in the local system or whether the application has been retrieved dynamically through a broadband connection from the internet. And to give Microsoft credit, and I think, yeah, because I think they've gone through a lot of grief over this, I think that they've seen that this is where the next generation of applications is going to be. Witness their Windows Live initiative, for example. I think they understand that Windows as a computing platform has a limited number of days ahead of it, and Windows as a virtual application is probably where the future lies on the software side for that company. But, you know, the future goes more slowly than we would like, and things don't get developed as quickly as you would like, especially in a large corporation. To give you an idea of what this means from the perspective of the user, I think the best example out there now is Flickr. And I'm sure many of you use Flickr. For those of you who are not familiar with Flickr, it's spelled F-L-I-C-K-R. It's a place to store your photographs online. And think about the typical sort of workflow in Flickr, where you can, you know, you take your photo either with your computer or your camera or your phone or whatever, your desk, your fishing rod, whatever. You know, they put cameras in everything these days. And you upload and tag your photo into Flickr, and that puts it basically into a content management system. But then if you want to edit your photo, do color corrections or add text or whatever, you invoke an application called Picnic. Picnic is actually a separate application from Flickr. It's run by a different company. It exists on a different website, different server. And what happens is Picnic and Flickr get together. Flickr sends your photo over to Picnic and then sends you over to Picnic. And now you're at Picnic. You're in their environment. You're editing your photo in Picnic. You edit your photo. You hit save. Bing, you're back into Flickr again. And then if you decide you want your photo to be a picture on a calendar or framed or printed or something like that, you select another application. Flickr sends you off to there with your photo, with your whole photo collection if you want, and you work there. The idea here is that you're going from one place to another place to another place. Your data follows you as you want, and each place you go to, you're manipulating your data in a different way. This is what we call Web 2.0, and I've talked about Web 2.0 a lot in the past, and I've approached it from a different direction. Hang on, I'll put more money in the machine. This is expensive, by the way, just so you know. Just kidding. It's still a lot cheaper than flying to Wisconsin, especially from the Canary Islands. I know there's no direct flights. what we call Web 2.0 is a much, much more pervasive change in paradigm than people acknowledge. A lot of people say that Web 2.0 is a fad, that Web 2.0 is some phase. But this is not the case. What Web 2.0 is, at heart, is the free movement of data from one website to another website to another website, with the movement of the user on top of that data, with interactions possible in each and every step. This allows for some very, very sophisticated applications. Picnic is just the tip of the iceberg. And none of these applications have to reside on our own computer, which saves us from the need to actually purchase them. So we can actually use very sophisticated applications, photo editors, those exist now, spreadsheet, Word applications, presentation tools, the works, without actually buying them. This is very useful for us. And even more importantly, we don't have to chart these applications around on our computer. We don't have to have an operating system environment that coordinates between those applications and our physical hardware. All of that is handled at the server end and by tools such as our web browser. So we can run the very minimum locally. We can keep our local computer environment very simple, even though we're accessing these very sophisticated tools. And yet, importantly, if we want to, if we need to, we can run applications locally. We're not simply using dumb terminals. It's not, who was it, Larry Ellison or someone said, the network is the computer. The computer is the network. It's not that. The computers that we're using, such as, here, have a look at it. There we go. It's kind of hard to show the computer with the eyesight because it's built into the computer. We're not using dumb terminals. We're using very sophisticated computers. But we're using them in a way that allows our applications to be very simple. There are two overriding trends of this hardware environment. First of all, is simplicity. I said in 1998, and I still say today, it's still absurd to think that a person would need to learn Windows in order to send a postcard. And today, we're getting to the point where all you need to know is how your browser works. And if you know how your browser works, maybe how to start it, although with a lot of computers it starts automatically these days, then you can send your postcard. And then secondly, invisibility. The idea that you need to manipulate a program is itself beginning to fade into the background. Think of how computer games operate today, playing Civilization or Sim Earth or Sim City or whatever, there's various games, of course. The model that we see in these is that the computer guides you, that you just start up the application and the application guides you through the things that you need to do. You don't need to learn anything. Basically, what you need to do is make choices and perform actions as time goes by. And the things that you need to know, the things that you need to think about, have been taken into account in the design of this software, and it presents one scenario, then another scenario, then another scenario. Each scenario based on where you've been, what you've done so far, and what preferences you've indicated, where it is that you want to be going. In most cases, for computer applications, learning how to use the system is something that simply won't be needed. So, that's the computer environment. And now we think about the educational environment. We think about what sort of technology we use in education and what sort of model education is. Education itself, and I sort of need to be careful about how I say this, but education itself is fundamentally a process of communication. Learning, something different from that, is fundamentally a process of growth. We need to separate these two things out. But as such, educators have over the years attempted to keep their tools, whatever their tools happen to be, relatively invisible and to focus on the teaching, that is to say, to focus on the communication. And this focus has traditionally been in education, not simply the presentation of content. Indeed, when you talk to educators about what education is, the discussion is very rarely the idea of the presentation of content. Rather, education has always been, as Terry Anderson says, about presence as much as it is about content. It's about that relation, that communication, that community. So, 10 years ago I wrote, to identify trends in education, perhaps the best methodology to identify trends which work well today, whether technologically based or not. In other words, it's probably best to identify what tools educators have actually used and continue to use over time. And if we look at the sort of tools that educators have been using, these tools remain staples, even today, even 10 years after the future of online learning. Tools like books and other reading implements remain staples today. Notepads or other writing implements remain staples. Blackboards, and even Blackboard, and other demonstration tools are staples in the education environment. Communication environments, in person, such as the classroom, online, such as this, remain staples. And things like facilitator or a teacher, somebody who, if you will, orchestrates the educational process. These things have remained the same before, during, and even after the advent of modern information and communication technology. So we ask, what has changed? I think, from my perspective, now, after a number of years of this rolling out in the online community, the big change has been in the nature of educational content. Educational content, certainly when I was growing up, and even 10 years ago, was about text. It was about reading books. It was about writing essays. Educational content is in the process of changing dramatically from text to interactive multimedia. Now, the YouTube video is as effective a way as communicating an idea as, say, oh, I don't know, the 1,000-word essay. The other big change is in the nature of the environment. Education used to be irreducibly local. It was the classroom, that was it. It has now changed to something that is global in nature. Even if you have a classroom, it's probably an online classroom, and you probably have somebody in the online classroom from Djibouti. That's just the nature of learning these days. As we progress into the future, we are still going to see some of the predictions that I made in the future of online learning. Specifically, education over time will continue to become more and more personal, and education over time will continue to become more and more mobile. We've lost our connection. And if you're listening on audio, I'm still trying to connect. It's like my internet connection itself has dropped. Well, there we go. And we're back. Yeah, I think the connection dropped at my end. It does that every once in a while here. I'm not sure what causes it. I think it's some sort of automatic cycling or rebooting, which is probably a good idea, but it does play havoc with things like this. Anyhow, how are we doing? We're doing okay then? Okay. And the actual image moved up and down when I asked that. Okay, hang on just a sec. And just so you know, I'm doing a video conference. It doesn't matter. You guys can feel free to use that, but I'll be talking to people, so as long as it doesn't disturb you. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so we got some other people using the other computers in this area, but I'm going to press on. Also, that's these, my earbuds are broken. Oh, here we go. Oh, this. Sorry about that. The piece falls out of my earbuds. There's my earbud, and it sometimes actually gets stuck in my ear, which is really kind of gross when you think about it. And I need to replace them. But there isn't really a good place to replace them. Anyhow, moving on. What I wanted to talk about, in 1998, I predicted the advent of something called the Personal Access Device, or PAD. And why is this doing that? And I think in the time since then, we've come close. We've had the tablet computer, which has come and gone. Sorry, I must have two versions of this running. Sorry, I'm just having some issues with my desktop here. Give me a second. Okay. Sorry about that. My apologies. It was a little technical glitch there. We've had things like the tablet computer, which came out. It was very innovative. It was very expensive. We've had the one laptop per child computer, which was very innovative and quite a bit less expensive. We've had the BlackBerry, and we've had more. We've also had another thing that I predicted back then called the wall area display, or WAD. So we've come close to the personal access device. I think we're still not quite there yet, but I think that we're getting there. I see what's happening. Combined with the personal access device, I'm going to have to move into this room. It's very distracting to keep talking behind me. Sorry, I wasn't anticipating that. Fortunately, I'm on wireless, so I can just move somewhere else and continue on with this presentation. I'll be back for a bit of a different kind of look to your presentation. On top of personal access devices like the PAD, I talked about presentation software. And I think presentation software has gone in two different directions. I think these directions are important. First of all, I'm just shifting to give myself better light. So that you don't see it dark in the room. There we go. On the one hand, we've had increasingly sophisticated do-it-yourself tools for video simulation, multimedia, and more. But on the other hand, and less talked about, we've had even more sophisticated tools created for specialists. And one of the things this allows them to do is to make increasingly sophisticated do-it-yourself tools. So it's interesting, I talked back in 1998 about do-it-yourself HTML, and I said back then that it would become too difficult for your average instructor to use, and in fact what happened is it became unnecessary. The tools made learning things like HTML unnecessary. What we see today, we see two things. We see people creating multimedia, creating videos, creating flash animations, creating lolcats of all things. And on the other hand, we see people presenting learning, conducting the educational process by, if you will, orchestrating access to these tools, by linking to them, by referring to them, rather than creating. So people create, but they also, link to or refer to these resources. Now, I want to point out, if I look uncomfortable, I am now actually sitting sideways on a set of stairs in a hotel. This is different. I thought the aircraft hangar was my most unique place to give a presentation. This now tops that. Educational software, the sophisticated side that I alluded to earlier, there's a whole industry that's grown up outside of traditional education, and it's something that we need to watch, although typically when we talk about online learning, most of us don't. You know, go to any software store and look at the wave of online and offline language learning applications. Look at the wave of children's educational software. There's a huge market in educational software that has developed outside the traditional learning environment. Back in 98, I said that this software would have all the features of video games. And this isn't the case for institutional software that is based on presentation. It isn't the case for learning management systems, for example. It isn't the case for conferencing systems like Illuminate. They don't look like video games at all. But for these standalone software applications, it is the case. You look at the load on these applications, and the software application will lead you through this educational process, whatever it happens to be. So I think there's a real divide happening here. I think there's a real divide between the very professionally produced educational software that is more and more being used outside the educational system, and the do-it-yourself sort of educational software that is being used inside the educational system in the context of institutional learning management systems. Outside the educational environment, virtual reality is here, and it's here and being used for educational purposes. I've talked in the past about SWAT, which is it's a type of combat game that's used by the Canadian military. I've talked about flight simulators and the helicopter simulators, again, that the military is using. There's a growing wave of immersive simulations being developed for all kinds of learning applications, usually military or industrial or corporate applications. But I think that this world is still the domain of a specialist, but I think that it will become huge when it becomes part of the do-it-yourself domain of online learning. And I think it will eventually, because I think the tools that allow people to create content are becoming more and more sophisticated as time goes by. You know, we look at Second Life, and the big thing about Second Life is not that it's a multi-user environment. We've had those for decades. It's not that it's a virtual reality environment. We've had those for decades. Alpha Worlds, for example, was around in 1998 when I wrote Future of Online Learning. What's huge about Second Life is the fact that anybody can go into that environment and create something. They can create their own little bit of virtual reality. And when that sort of capacity is taken out of Second Life and made mainstream, when that sort of capacity can be applied anywhere and not just in that environment, that sort of thing becomes huge. So the future of educational technology, I think, is a combination of these trends. And what do I mean? Well, for one thing, the future will have the characteristic of types of immersive simulations or games. On the other hand, the future of educational technology will also focus on or allow access through mobile personal devices. And there will be an emphasis on content consumption, content creation, presentation, facilitation, communication, the basic elements of education, the basic elements of educational technology. If you want to think about where educational technology is going in the future, think Second Life meets civilization meets Facebook, and that's the future of educational technology. Now, just let me check my time here. I think I'm... that makes it 11:16 a.m., which means 9:16 a.m., and this is probably a good place to bring the presentation part to a close, particularly as I'm dealing with stairs and wind and all kinds of other circumstances, and see if there's any comments on what I've had to say this morning and any questions. So why don't I do that? Anybody? can see somebody moving, but I'm hearing no sound at this point in time. And still hearing no sound. And still hearing no sound. And now seeing a very big person, hopefully turning on the sound. And I see you waving. Why is there no sound? Ah, there we go. Yes, I do. I knew it was your fault. Yes. Yep. Well, I think standards are critical in a certain sense, and I've been critical of standards because I think standards are so important, and I think that it's been mismanaged to a large degree, and I think that the standard process has been hijacked to a large degree. Can I get you to mute that while I respond? And I'll just, because I'm getting a pretty bad echo. Okay, thank you. There we go. That's so much better. Thank you. It's really hard to talk with something go whoop, 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 whoop right in your ear, which is what it was doing. Standards are what make interactivity possible. I mean, the alternative to standards are these monolithic, you know, learning management type systems or these monolithic Second Life type systems, right? You don't have Web 2.0. You don't have distributed access. You don't have distributed content. Standards make communication possible. Standards make distributed computing possible. Standards make interactivity possible. So clearly, I think standards are important. Now we come to the question, twofold question. First of all, which standards? Secondly, how are these standards created? First of all, which standards? A big part of the effort in learning object standards has been learning object metadata, and this effort and efforts like Dublin Core, the standards have been mostly bibliographic standards. They've been publication standards. They're not standards that promote interactivity and communication. Rather, they're intended to, to paraphrase Norm Friesen, they're intended to support discovery, modularity, interoperability, reuse. In other words, the picture presented by standards is a picture of online content as though it were published content, as though it were like books, and which I think is a misapplication of standards. I think that the development of standards going forward... Sorry? Okay. All right. Yeah, and I've got a lot of background noise here. A lot. And they're coming from all directions, from above, from below. Oh, man. This is why you're having audio issues. So, sorry, I'm running down the hall hiding. I had somebody waiting for me on the stairs to move and get out of the way. Is the audio any better now? I can honestly say I've never given one quite like this. This is definitely a unique experience. Although, it is working. I mean, it's a bit odd, but it is working. The thing I wanted to say about standards, again, I think it all comes back to process. When standards are imposed from the top down, when standards are created by standards bodies who sit in rooms and think about what these things could be used for, you get things like learning object metadata. You get things based on, first of all, established interests, secondly, the speculations of the people involved, which may or may not be accurate. You know, I've had the phrase that I've used many times, the people who create learning object metadata standards should be required to write software using those standards. I have written software using those standards, and I think that if the people writing the standards had used the software, written software, they would have done it very, very differently. They certainly would have made things a lot simpler, a lot less complicated. I've long been an advocate of the grassroots process of standards creation, the RSS model of standards creation, where standards, simple standards, evolve out of a need and through widespread adoption. I don't want to say it's the evolutionary school of standards, because that's not really an accurate depiction of evolution, but it's that sort of idea, right? Where you put something out, if it becomes, you know, if it serves a need, it becomes widespread, it becomes much more used. You know, we have this ongoing tension between large companies and other interests who want to impose certain views of standards in order to satisfy their own particular market needs or interests, up against this more use-based, grassroots-based approach to standards. And that's why I've been critical of standards in the past, precisely for that reason. You know, it's the depiction of standards on the one hand as legislation as compared to standards on the other hand as protocol or practice or custom. And I will follow protocol, practice, or custom every time. I'm back in the stairwell, by the way. They've all left. Yeah. Oh, and let me just put some more money in the machine here, too, while we're at it. You laugh. Here's the money. Here's the machine. All right. Yeah, I wish I had my notes with me more, because I could actually refer to specific products and services. But how does this work? Approach it this way. You have a computer like my computer here, the MacBook, and the MacBook doesn't run, you know, the Macintosh operating system doesn't run Windows, which of course figures, and you need Windows for some stuff. Like video editing, because Macintosh video editing system is awful. So companies make software that allow me to run Windows applications on the Macintosh. And basically what this software is an interface between the Windows operating system itself and the physical layer underneath. The physical layer being the actual hardware that the Macintosh runs on. The actual device drivers. Now, this becomes important because if you look at Windows as it is, as it's currently built, okay, that must be the wind. How's that? Is that better? No? All right, yeah, we're probably getting wind background noise here. I'm moving down the stairs. How's that? Is that better? Yeah, less wind. Okay, so if you think of Windows, the way Windows is currently constituted, most of Windows, like, you know, on a byte-for-byte basis, most of Windows is composed of device drivers. Interfaces Wow. Gee, I don't know how to fix that. Pardon? Okay, okay, how's this? I'm hoping this is better. Anyhow, most of Windows consists of these device drivers, these interfaces between Windows and any of the hundreds of different particular bits of hardware. The still audio problems? Okay, good. The hundreds of different devices, disk drives, printers, you name it. Now, imagine Windows without all of those. Windows becomes something very different. And this is what these virtualization systems do. What they do is they handle the hardware interface for you. So Parallels basically gives Windows a way to talk to Macintosh devices, to talk to the EyeSight camera in the Macintosh, to talk to the audio input in the Macintosh. And so what these virtualization systems do is create a mechanism whereby it doesn't matter what hardware your operating system is running on. Your operating system no longer has to worry about the hardware configuration. This allows for increasingly varied and increasingly sophisticated hardware configurations. It used to be, if you added a second processor or a third processor or whatever in a Windows environment, you would horribly confuse the Windows environment. Well, you wouldn't confuse it, but you would make it a lot more complicated, and you would make the Windows, the operating system itself, a lot more complicated. But with a virtualization system, you can simply add processors on like Legos. Just plop them on, the virtualization system will handle it. Your Windows operating system won't even notice the difference. The virtualization system handles the task allocation, the time sharing, the data exchange, and all of that. The operating system does what it does. It handles things like application management, dynamic device loading, copy and paste between applications, that sort of thing. This allows our operating system to become mobile, and mobile in a very genuine way. Mobile in the sense that it can be put onto a thumb drive, for example. Mobile in the sense that your operating system, and indeed the application that you're running on, and even the very text on your screen, can be simply stored online somewhere for you to pick up later on using completely different hardware configuration, completely different computer, and you just resume as though you would never shut off your computer at all. Now again, like I say, I don't have my notes with me here, but there are a number of companies specializing in these virtualization systems, and the number of applications that run depending on them. Good. Thanks a lot, and thanks for your patience in this, as you say, experimental configuration. Bye, everyone.